Colonel Wyatt Trefoil.
I went on talking to the headman, telling him what a nice village he had and what brave men his villagers looked like, while I was thinking what was the final plan that I had used to persuade him to take me across. I decided alcohol, and I asked him if there was any alcohol in the village, and he told me he got some flagons of palm toddy, and so I drank palm toddy with him and the villagers who owned the country boats till midnight, by which time they were singing. And suddenly he said, "We go!" And in these three country boats with the ammunition, we went across 3/4 of a mile of Mekong River in the moonlight. They were singing at the tops of their voices. And we were lucky. We hit the spot where, by signal, we knew the French were going to be. And it's not all that easy at night to move in darkness and know exactly where things are happening. We delivered the arms and ammunition to the French. We got away unscathed. I had a terrible headache the next morning.
What was the object of arming them?
Because we knew, or the SOE knew, it was chaotic everywhere, and the orders hadn't come through what to do. And so we wanted the French escapees to have a chance to defend themselves if they were being sought by Japanese with ill intent. It was just that chaotic period there. The Japanese hadn't been disarmed. They hadn't had the full tale. They'd heard about the first atomic bomb being dropped and that there was probably going to be a surrender and so on.
What about local French Indochinese rebels in the area? Did you have any contact with them or any apprehension of them?
No, only contact with about these 30 French civilians. We knew. I did make a contact later on, because when I went up north to a place called Thakek to cross over the river there and see what the political situation was and report back, I found a French lady parachutist in Thakek. And she'd been, never got to the bottom of it, she'd been landed there to try and cross the Mekong River and make contact in Laos. And unlike us, where we land and we roll right or roll left, she had a Sorbo rubber pad, and her parachute training for the ladies in France was to sit down as they landed. She was a very, very pretty girl.
What was her name?
Francoise. I don't know the surname.
What condition were the French escapees in?
They weren't too bad. They weren't anything like as emaciated as our own service prisoners of war. So presumably they'd been looked after reasonably.
And these towns like Paxe, Thaket, Savanakhet are in what we would now call Laos, aren't they?
Well, Thaket is in Laos, and Paxe is in, Paxe was then in French Indochina. It would be, what do we call it all now?
It's Laos, Cambodia and Vietnam now, but it sounds as though it's the part which we call Laos.
Laos, yes, in Laos.
How many of these French internees did you say there were?
About 30.
All men?
All men, yeah. It was, I must say, out there, it was the most confusing situation I've ever met in my life.
So this French lady was some kind of agent who had been sent in?
She was going to wait in Thakek until the time she got a signal. She had a wireless. until she got a signal to go and do her stuff in Laos. But she was there when we arrived there, and he was still there when we left.
So how long were you with her?
Only about 2 days.
Did she seem to speak any of the local languages?
A little Siamese.
Had she come from the area? Was she from?
As far as I can make out, she'd been sent in from Calcutta.
Any other memories you've got from those days of doing that Rakwi work?
No, those were the main things. I do remember when I finally left the Ubon area, I went by train with the last of the prisoners of war. Some of them went back by train. And in one of the cattle trucks with straw on the floor, there was a Siamese lady from Ubon. She was going to have a baby and had got some other illness and taken back to Bangkok to go into hospital. And I helped Dr. Lang, give birth to her in the cattle truck on the way to Bangkok. Quite an experience. But there, these things happen. And I got the message in Bangkok that we were to take 4 days rest in Bangkok before we flew back to Calcutta and then back to my battalion in Quetta.
How had you come across David Smiley?
David Smiley, because he was connected with SOE, and he was going to be part of the disarming job, disarming the Japanese servicemen in the area. He had a man called Hudson and a man called Headley with him. And they were going to be responsible for, there was a total of a Jap division, 3 regiments in the whole of the area, and they were going to disarm them and take all the weapons in. And when I left him, he was still in Ubon.
What impression did these other two make on you who were with Smiley?
Most impressed with Hudson. And impressed in another way with the third one, Headley, whose impatience had to be seen to be believed, because I saw the beginning of a Japanese regiment being disarmed and the meticulous way in which he checked every rifle, every round of ammunition. He would even count. He even started to count one box of 1,000 rounds to see if they were all there. That is, by the way, he was obviously going to do the job with great meticulousness. The other two, Smiley and Hudson, I regarded as what I would imagine were typical guerrilla leaders. Great operators. I can tell, you know, the way they spoke, the way they acted, full of admiration. I call the other man a really good admin man.
What do you mean about the way they spoke and acted as typical guerrilla leaders?
Well, they told me all about Yugoslavia, what had happened, and how they'd come in to Ubon, and they told me what was going to happen, various forays they were going to make into Indochina. You can tell an operator compared with an administrator.
A man of action, you mean?
Man of action.
Now, can we jump ahead to December 1950, when you were in Hong Kong? Because I think there was a sense of crisis there at the time because of the communist takeover of China. Can you tell me what unit you were serving with and in what capacity and what you remember of those days, please?
I was then with the 1st Battalion South Staffords, who were in a camp near Fanling. And as you look east and west from Fanling, you see a rough road, and to the south of the rough road, the mountains going up to 2,000 or 3,000 feet, and as you look north, about a mile or mile and a half, you can see flat land going to a river where the other side is China. We were in a camp just to the south of this road with dug-in positions, dug-in and revetted in the hills behind us, ready for a possible incursion by the Chinese across the river. We had an operation laid on in case we were cut off in these mountains, where we come back from the south with mules to replenish the mountains in the back of the defence positions with ammunition. And one of my tasks was, as a company commander, if this happened, to take over the rifle company and the mule operation. And so I did a lot of reconnaissance of the whole of the mountain area in there. And one of the areas I came across, oddly enough, was a defence position that had been dug by the British north of Hong Kong before the war started. And it consisted of a string of what I call World War I concrete dugouts, about a quarter of a mile apart in the hills, and it was called the Gin Drinker's Line. And my opinion of that was, because of the mountainous area in which they're in, it would be fairly simple for anyone to take those dugouts piecemeal, one by one, take them out. As it happened, the Japanese just went through overnight. But from there, anyway, I knew all the trails by which to take in arms and ammunition to the soldiers, dug in on the top of the hills facing the Chinese border. Very interesting area, because I remember one of my reconnaissances, I saw some Chinese digging up under a tree and taking some little white things out, and I eventually found there were white truffles. You know of black truffles.
Yes.
And they explained, and I'm quite sure, these were white truffles. And they do have white truffles in Italy as well, which are considered to be an even bigger delicacy than the black truffle.
Did you see the forces of the Chinese Red Army?
No. No, not even with binoculars on the river. Except to say there were some always gathered around the major crossing point of the river, which is a place called Lo Wu. That's where the railway from China comes to the border, and passengers are taken off across the river there, put onto another railway. There were always Chinese there.
Doing routine duties?
Routine duties.
Did you think that they would attack?
We thought they would attack if they won in Korea. But they didn't win in Korea, and so they didn't attack.
What did the attitude of the local civilians in Hong Kong seem to be about the prospects of a Chinese attack?
I think they're very pro-British. We felt that. Though I must say, we were only allowed in once a month. I only had 12 visits to Hong Kong all the time I was there, because we were at such short notice to stand to in our mountainous positions. But it's interesting to think that pre-war, you could get on a railway in London, go across on a required boat in your railway carriage, and eventually finished up in Hong Kong near the Peninsula Hotel. It could make a rail journey the whole of the way to Hong Kong pre-war.
What about handling your troops in Hong Kong? Were there any problems there?
None at all. Our troops were very good. Well, they're regular soldiers, plus some national servicemen, and the national servicemen were absolutely first class. In fact, one of those national servicemen in Hong Kong lives half a mile away from here on the edge of the golf course. And because he was a South Stafford, a private soldier there, has done extremely well, has got a lovely house, people hit their balls from the first tee out of bounds and they go over into his garden, quite a lot of them, so I never have to buy any golf balls. I'm a very good friend of his.
Were the troops in Hong Kong allowed to form amorous relationships with the Hong Kong population?
Well, all the brothels were in out-of-bounds area. And if they were caught, literally it was the maximum detention straight away. That was the greatest danger. The out-of-bounds area were patrolled vigorously by military policemen, but VD was rife in Hong Kong and in the neighbouring villages.
So I know that from speaking to people who served in Hong Kong before 1941, that they had regular Chinese girlfriends in the town. Yeah. Did that ever happen?
No. Because any time the soldier went in, it was in a military truck, and the trucks left sharp at 11.
Now, jumping ahead again to 1956, you were in Cyprus during the Eoka emergency. Can you tell me your memories about that and the capacity you served in there?
Yes, I was a company commander, commanding a company in Cyprus. We were stationed in Nicosia. And this was 55 and 56, at the height of the Eoka troubles. And I suppose every week, at least twice a week, we were out on call without any warning and briefed about 10:30 for the village we would go to be searched the next morning. So for months on end, it was continual joining up with the police, going to these villages, rounding up a number of head people there, and then going into every house and trying the floorboards and everything like that, searching for weapons and ammunition. Sometimes we found it, sometimes we didn't. And in 1956, during my last 3 months there, suddenly one night I was warned, I got my wife out with me there, to be ready for a lung operation, and we left Nicosia and had 14 weeks in the Trudos Mountains, searching the whole time. We never got him. And the mountains, I found I was fortunately able to handle well, because I'd just come from 2.5 years with NATO in Oslo, skiing, and so all my muscles were right for mountain climbing. And where there is loose shale, I found I could go down just as if I was skiing, where the other troops were so damn slow. But there's pure ski training. And while we were there, in one area, from Scottish battalions, something like 10 to 12 Scottish soldiers died, being caught in a mountainous area along a path where Aoka set fire to the jungle on all sides. And they literally died through suffocation. It is very hard to find anyone when the sympathies of the populace are with the people that you're trying to find. Extremely difficult.
Do you think their sympathies really were with them?
Do you think what?
Their sympathies really were with you, okay?
Because all our village searches were in the Greek Cypriot area, rather than the Turkish Cypriot area, because we knew Grievous did not go into the Turkish Cypriot area. And the Greek Cypriots were for Makarios and Grievous. And so they were, it was dumb insolence as far as we were concerned. You couldn't get anything out of them.
So how did you handle them?
Well, I suppose any village of 200 people, if you've got 800 soldiers, it's not difficult to man each street and then have a party that does the search house by house, each party having a police representative with it. No difficulty.
What was the role of the police representative?
To speak the language, and B, I suppose, to take the people in, any of the people that we arrested. Very good people.
How did you know who to arrest?
In all the searches we did, over all this time, we never arrested any, never found any.
Was any damage done in the searches?
Minor damage, but there wasn't. Now, there you are. The police were there. They were the form of deciding what the compensation should be. We were certainly near to Grievous several times in the Trudos Mountains, but we never got him. Because we assumed it, we kept coming on places where they had slept the night before. But you couldn't get any hard intelligence.
Did you discover any arms?
No. No arms at all.
So it was totally fruitless?
Absolutely fruitless.
How long were you doing this job for?
We were only 9 months.
Did you suffer any casualties?
No. Even though bombs went off in Cyprus, yes, I think we had a total of 4 casualties not killed in bombs being detonated as vehicles were going over them.
In the countryside?
In Nicosia. Because our camp was in Whittington Barracks, our own regimental barracks called Whittington Barracks, just outside Nicosia near the airfield.
Were you anywhere near the bomb when it went off?
No. No, I wasn't.
What was the attitude of your men towards doing this kind of work?
I don't know whether you know the Staffordshire soldier.
No.
Provided he is well led and well looked after, he happily does anything he's told to do, including digging trenches, filling it in and digging another trench the next night. They can dig like no one else I've met.
Why?
And they're all mining stock. They're all short. My God, they can't dig in. they're wonderful soldiers. Wonderful soldiers. Great tragedy there. The threat is of amalgamation.
So they didn't mind doing this work?
No. No, I think they enjoyed it. No. No, they didn't mind a bit.
What was your own attitude towards being there and conducting this kind of emergency operation?
I wanted to be the one that found Grievous. My gosh, I did.
So you must have felt frustrated.
Yes. Yes, I did.
What did you feel about the support that you got from the civil authorities?
They were very helpful. On the surface. But no hard information. You never knew whether they knew.
Did you get help from the Turks?
Well, they were willing to help us, but they wouldn't come into the Cypriot area. They kept tightly to their area. And right through Nicosia in those days, along Leader Street, one side is Turkish, and all to the north, to the coast at Kyrenia, all to the south is Greek Cypriot.
What did you think of operating in Nicosia as opposed to the countryside?
Well, I suppose Nicosia was one of the best bases to be there. It was reasonably central to the main villages, had an airfield, and you could be anywhere you wanted in the countryside within a few hours. It's only a small island.
Now, jumping ahead again, can we go on to Aden?
Yes.
You were there from 60 to 63. How you came to be there, please?
I was called in to the office of the United Kingdom Army Liaison Staff in Canada at the end of a two-year tour in about September 1960 and said, "You're for Aden."